Severin Films presents the first ever authorized Blu-ray in America of Sergio Stivaletti's Wax Mask, produced by Dario Argento from a story by Lucio Fulci. Wax Mask was to be Fulci's last movie, but he passed on to The Beyond during pre-production, so Gore FX maestro Stivaletti took over and created a splatastic House of Wax Grand Guignol Italian horror epic, packed with commentary, behind-the-scenes footage, and a feature-length making-of featuring Argento, Stivaletti, and cast and crew, plus the limited edition slipcase version includes a remastered soundtrack CD. Dario Argento presents Wax Mask on Blu-ray. Also, Don't Crawl, Run, Killer Crocodiles coming to Blu-ray from Zombie and the Beyond producer Fabrizio De Angelis and FX guru Gianetto De Rossi comes the Italian giant croc gut muncher you've been waiting for the first time ever in America. Limited slipcase edition includes the equally crunchy human reptile fodder flick Killer Crocodile 2. Packed to the teeth with special features and available at www.severin-films.com. Bundles and deals and pins and shirts and the most sordid and sickening kind available only at www.severin-films.com. Why, we still have a few copies left of The Uncanny, starring Peter Cushing, Ray Milland, Donald Pleasance, with limited slipcover, and the last copies of the Hemisphere Box of Horrors, featuring The Blood Drinkers, Curse of the Vampires, Brain of Blood, and The Black Cat. And all of this can be found at www.severin-films.com. Fright Rags is the number one source for horror t-shirts. With specially curated collections created by renowned horror artists, they offer the best art and the best quality anywhere. Turn back the pages of your childhood for some scary stories to tell in the dark. An all-new collection of shirts based on the brand new movie out today. Also, Fright Rags is busting some ghosts with their all-new collection of Ghostbusters tee, socks, and pins to celebrate the iconic film's 35th anniversary. Listeners get 10% off with the code WAVES10. Again, that is 10% off by using code WAVES10.
Welcome to Shockwaves 156.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's what this episode will be. All righty. I assume you guys know who we are since the guy over there just introduced us, but.
Like a sports game is cool.
But if you're listening at home and it's your first episode ever, we are Shockwaves. I'm Rob Gluzzo, Elric Kane, Rebecca McKendry.
Hello.
Ryan Turek is our fourth host, but he's busy in Haddonfield right now as we speak, which is very exciting.
Making movies.
Making a couple of them.
Yeah. So we've brought in a nice co-host to join us today for this.
Another expert in ghost movies. Wrote a book on them. Fellow director, writer, Axel Carolyn, come on up.
And thank you guys so much for joining our live show at the Midsummer Scream Con. We're so excited to be here. This is, we've done this for a couple of years now. We looked at shark films, and last year, what did we count down last year?
Vampires.
We did vampires last year.
With Tom Holland and Dave Parker, yeah.
And so, yeah, we're totally excited to be back. And this year, we are going to be counting down our, we thought about doing scariest, but we ended up going with our personal five favorite haunted house films, because we figured there'd be a lot more variety. It gives us a lot more chance to kind of show personality in deep cuts. And if we go scariest, like, we'd all pick similar films. So we wanted some more variety. And so everyone had homework in advance, correct?
Right.
Yep.
I barely did it, though. I picked five and I don't even remember the five.
Well, that's good because I have PowerPoint presentation that I made.
So I'm going to wing it. As soon as I see it, I'm going to tell you why I emotionally felt compelled by my choices.
I wrote down my list on a piece of paper and I felt very, very fancy.
I know. So I control the PowerPoint presentation.
Oh, look at that.
So you want to look over there.
Guys, made some fancy shit here, okay?
All right.
It's going to be like a tennis game.
So welcome to the Shockwaves podcast, favorite haunted house films countdown. I even included talking points.
Oh.
Take that.
So we have to hit those?
All right, this is better when we had that machine that made noises like babies crying.
I know that was the toilet flushing machine. So I when I started looking at these, I realized that haunted house films are one of the oldest subgenres that we have of horror, just because it's when we kind of think of at least the invention of what we'll consider Western horror, like when did horror become a thing here in the States? It's Gothic horrors in the 1800s with Mary Shelley and Edgar Allan Poe and people like that. So the haunted house film has been with us forever.
Yeah, and ghosts are a big part of the haunted house. And I think because it's the one thing that we can't really prove doesn't, I mean, we can pretty much prove vampires and werewolves and so forth don't exist. No, anyone's guess is as good as the next. And I know for a fact that as a kid, the only thing that really scared me was the house and what could be ghosts. Like the idea of vampires and that kind of scared me, but the one thing that to this day kind of still can spook me is the idea of the unknown and what's in the dark at night and the creaks and the natural sounds of a house. I remember being like 10 and my mom told me a story when she was, and she doesn't believe in this stuff, but she was in a house in France and they were looking to rent an apartment and they walked in and they felt the utter repulsion of being in there. She said she'd never felt anything like it. She turned to my dad and he said, they asked the real estate person, like, why are we feeling like this? And he said, the person who just left this place jumped out the window and killed themselves. And when somebody who's a skeptic tells you that kind of stuff, it definitely, especially at a young age, it stays with you. You start thinking about the residue left behind in places, you know?
And I love the fact that if you look at horror across all cultures, like if you go back and look at folklore and kind of what we've been telling as spooky stories across all cultures since the dawn of man and the element of storytelling, the two things that are prevalent everywhere, no matter where you are from, are zombies. We're all scared of our dead coming back. And two, ghosts. We're all scared that after someone shuffles off this mortal coil that they're somehow still there and that they want to do ill harm for us. It's never stories about, you know, yeah, grandpa's still around and, you know, occasionally he dusts the floors. It's always about, you know, them trying to like fuck with our normal day-to-day lives. So yeah, it's been with us forever.
I did research. I mean, just so you guys know why I'm sitting here, I guess, I'm obsessed with ghosts. My first feature was about a haunted house, which I'm expecting to see in everybody's
list.
Number one
on all lists, all three.
Soulmate.
Kiss it's called Soulmate. It's on Shudder. But I also wrote a book about ghosts, ghost movies, and I did some research for that in the background, kind of like what you said about ghosts being very international. And one of the stories that I found was, I think it's ancient Greece, and it was this philosopher who was spending the night in this abandoned house. And he says he heard the rattling of chains and then a kind of like a weird howling sound, which sounds exactly like every depiction of a haunted house I've ever heard. And he saw an apparition and he followed the apparition, and the next day he explained what he saw and where it disappeared, and they dug up the ground where that thing disappeared and they found some bones, and so they had to put the bones to rest, and then the apparition was never came back. And it was such a, like, that's Poltergeist. That's like every horror movie I've ever seen. So it's fascinating. It's 2,000 years old.
Even in that origin story, the ghosts always have a message. I mean, even if we look at like Shakespeare's Hamlet, the ghost comes back with a message of, I need you to do this or don't do this. And they always have a purpose. It's never just like hanging around.
Well, unfinished business. That seems to be the common through line. It's not everyone becomes a ghost. Those who become ghosts weren't ready to move on, weren't aware. I remember always hearing stories about people if they were shot from behind or something, somehow they weren't even aware they were deceased. Weird things like that. So there's some unfinished element to it, I think.
So, and we are still going strong almost 200 years later. So, and I mean, and it's way more than that because, again, ghost stories have been with us since man first started telling stories. But these were just ones that have come out within the past couple of years that really made a big impact, or ones that I just think are really cool films. So, yeah.
If you haven't seen Haunting of the Hill House, you have to. It's so good.
Yeah,
that series is brilliant.
The Last Shift is one that was kind of like came out of nowhere for me, and I discovered it on Netflix and was like, oh my God, this one's like, it would have been in my top five scariest had we gone that route. Okay. And they still span all cultures. I had to work Tigers Are Not Afraid in there somewhere because it's coming soon. So Tigers Are Not Afraid is a Mexican horror film, which is coming to Shudder. Did they pick that up? And it is in this drug-torn country, focusing on the children kind of living in the relics of a city that once was, and there's ghosts. And it's amazing. And it's kind of what I think good horror films are most successful at. It's telling a story of something that's happening, but it's being channeled through the horror. Like, the ghosts are there, they're not the focus, but this other story is being channeled through it. It's mm-hmm. really tight.
Housebound, I have conflicted feelings about that one. But it would be a spoiler.
It'd be a spoiler to discuss
whether it's a haunted house.
Well, now so you just literally gave it away because it wouldn't be a spoiler.
No one knows yet.
The simple fact that you said it would be a spoiler to discuss whether or not it's a haunted house just gave it away.
Watch the movie and then tell me if it's a spoiler. I'm conflicted about it on a PowerPoint.
Yes, you did. It's a spoiler.
You did that. So, is there a formula for haunted house films? I mean, I think that there's some tropes that we can kind of tease out of it. Like, it's always a family who has moved into the house, but sometimes it isn't. But I think that we do see that a lot. That, I felt like, started in around the 1970s when we look at the adult horror films from then. Things like The Changeling, Amityville, Burnt Offerings. It's always about, like, even Poltergeist. Like, we're just moving in, and it's a whole new start. Insidious kind of starts that way. Sinister, yeah. Family moves in.
And the families are always like, well, mostly in those examples, economically, they need to move into this house because the house is somehow discounted at that time, and that's why we're getting a good deal, especially one of my picks coming up where it's like, wow, we get this whole house for summer for $900. It's like, that's a really good deal. Oh, by the way, our grandma's going to be here too, so you have to look after her. It's like, wait, okay. So you're right, that is a pretty... I don't know besides that, though, why that would always be about a new group of people entering.
Well, I think that kind of sets up the scare a bit more, because if it's like, yeah, we've been here for 30 years and now weird shit starts going on, I think that it's easier to say, well, we've just arrived into this situation and we're unfamiliar with it.
I guess The Others is an exception to that. Mm-hmm. Although the servants move in, I guess.
How long have they been there in Paranormal Activity? Like, was there a catalyst that set it off? I haven't seen it recently enough.
Actually, I don't remember why that starts. Is it a Ouija board thing that kicks off the haunting there?
Audience? Why does Paranormal Activity?
It has been years since I've seen.
I thought they explained it like by 2 and 3.
Yeah,
I thought they like rewrote.
I mean,
she's been haunted
since the beginning.
She was haunted.
Yeah.
The person was haunted in one of the main characters.
Okay. Katie Featherston is haunted.
So it keeps going with her.
That's right. Okay. And she had been in a fire when she was little, and then that's right.
So, okay.
And actually, that's an example of quite a few of these. The person has been haunted, and it's drawn to them.
It's not the house. It's your son.
It's the person. Yeah. Yeah. You're right.
Yeah. So some of them have formulas. I definitely think that we see formulas in how the haunting takes place, and we can usually pinpoint what movie kind of set it off, like Bleeding Walls. Oh, that's Amityville, the house yelling at you. You know, a lot of these may be Amityville. But ghost rattling, or chain rattling, apparently goes back to Greece, which I was not aware of. That's really cool. Okay, so let's dive into our countdown. Number 5.
What a graphic. Wow.
I know, right?
Part chicken, part brain.
I used Google.
Who would have thought? I like it.
This is mine. It's The Entity, which technically, I mean, this is. I had a problem with haunted house as our subject because I really thought about movies that scared me, and it's not exactly about the house. So I was like, can it be ghosts? Can it be haunting in general? Because I can't think of any houses except for like several Amityville sequels. So this one is one, I actually just revisited it like 2 weeks ago because I saw it maybe when I was 10, 11, 12. Mm-hmm. Whenever I saw The Exorcist, I immediately went and saw this movie and it disturbed me so much I've been too scared to watch it since. And I feared if I watch it again, it will either continue to terrify me or it won't hold up. It's somewhere in the middle. I still think it's really effective, but it definitely wasn't nearly as scary as I remember as a little kid.
But part of that is because you've seen it. Like, the first half is still pretty frightening, the concept of it.
Yeah, and basically it's loosely based on a true story about a woman that not only is haunted but repeatedly gets raped by ghosts, and they kind of show it in a way that's really just awful. Like, you just see indentations against her skin, like holding her down, and it's like, it's graphic, and they're screaming, and even the music. I think it's Charles Bernstein. I may be wrong on that, but
and
even
an A-list actor, which is very unusual.
Barbara Hershey. Yeah. And I mean, it's interesting because she did that movie, and then the rumor was that she would never talk about it. Mm. Like, you just couldn't ask her about the entity. And it's like, it kind of adds to the mystique of the movie. Like, oh, but what happened while they were shooting it that she's too scared to talk about it or whatever? I think she just didn't want to talk about it. Mm. But then, which was a pleasant surprise when later on, I think it was James Wan brought her into the Insidious movies.
Insidious 2, yeah.
She's in one. And then, and she's on the new Blu-ray that they just released through Scream Factory. And she talks pretty candidly about the whole experience and, you know, nothing supernatural happened to her. It's just, it's a pretty deep, just to get into that character's mindset and deal with what you have to deal with. But to
and she
me,
was playing a real person.
Yeah, a real person. And, I actually met, there's a parapsychologist in the movie. I don't know if they even use his real name, but the guy in the real case was Barry Taff. Hmm. And I actually had to interview him for a documentary for a friend, and like the candle behind him like fell over, and like like I knew exactly who I was, like, oh, this is the guy from the real life entity, and weird shit just happened in the room, and I don't really believe, but like he obviously has that energy because he deals with the real life version of this, and I was like, oh, all right.
I always found it very weird that when you see interviews, when he talks about the time where he investigated this case, he's still talking about it like the most exciting time of his life.
Yeah.
And we're talking about a woman who was repeatedly raped,
right.
And was repeatedly assaulted in front of her kids, and I'm like, that's the most exciting ever, like, time of your life, dude? That's a little bit odd.
But she moved.
I think she moved out of state, and then she came back, and everywhere she moved, that thing followed her. And one of the things that I found the scariest is that I remember reading she died maybe 15 years after the film was made, and she died of organ failure, and no one really knows why. Like, just happened.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah, so it's terrifying. If you haven't seen it, definitely check out The Entity.
Yeah, and it feels like an assault, that movie.
It does.
Just feels like you're being assaulted with it, which I think is good filmmaking because it's not glamorizing. And I actually don't think it's sexualizing her in a way that's meant to be evocative. I think they really are showing it. And like, at least for me as a young man seeing it, I was really disturbed and horrified. You know, sorry to
it's
put
okay.
you off your
I,
PowerPoint,
I can go back
nerd.
And forth. We're on a strict schedule
okay,
here, Elric.
Yeah, okay.
So my number five is House on Haunted Hill, the reboot, which is a weird one to pick because, I mean, I love the original film so much, but this hit me at just this perfect age to watch it. 1999, it was just so fun. And it really did kind of mark a new point in horror where we were really starting to play around with digital technology at this point. And so the scares that are set up in this were so effective at the time period. I watched it a couple of years ago, and you can kind of see the digitization now. Like, it doesn't look as good as I recall it looking at theatrically in 1999. But it was one of the first times when I'd seen Creepy Walk outside of Jacob's Ladder. And Jeffrey Combs is just amazing.
Yes.
And the opening, the cold open of this with the roller coaster is just dynamite.
Yeah, and Jeffrey Rush is playing Vincent Price, which is super cool.
Yeah.
That's a fun movie.
Okay.
Elric,
get out.
Amityville Horror.
Yeah, this movie, it would be my number one scariest for me. This film, I don't remember. I think the last time I remember being scared by a movie was the rewatch of this about 15 years ago. The last time I was scared. Like, I mean, you can get shocked in a movie, but I mean, like, I didn't want to turn off lights and I felt like unnerved being alone in a home. And it was real. It's actually just the wide shot where you see the eyes of the house. There was something about a house as a living organism that really creeps me out because all houses really are, and they are all kind of fed by the people in it and the families. And so if the family and the life in it is negative, you can see why it might feel that way, whether you believe in supernatural or not. But this film, I think it's also the cinematography, the way this film looks and feels, it has that kind of, it's quite a dreamy look. It's not docu-realism. It's like a lot of films in this time are like somewhat fogged in terms of cinematography. I find that inherently creepy. Another one of my picks later on has the same thing. And there's something about it that feels like, I don't know, I'm dead already or something watching a movie. I don't like it, but I find it evocative. But Brolin's great in this. Margot Kidder, Rod Steiger, it's like got a really good cast. It's, to me, next to Poltergeist, you know, it's the origin of the haunted house in suburbia. The haunted house where something truly horrific happened. Because anytime I hear the facts of that case, you know, I won't say I'm not a believer, because like you, if we ever say I don't believe in ghosts, you're about to get haunted, so I don't do that. That would be foolish. But the fact that everyone was facing down in their beds, you know, when they're all shot in the back of the heads at the same time, this family, in real life, like, there's something about that fact that I find very chilling and really hard to kind of rationalize. You know, of course, it's possible, depending on who came into this house and committed that crime, but the fact that it spawned all these sequels that are usually pretty goofy. Number two is a total masterpiece, of course.
It's About Time.
It's so much fun. About Time, that's a good one. Good last line. But this movie is really scary. I started watching a little bit of it this morning, and it's still just unnerving, and I don't think it gets the respect. I feel people all the time just go, oh, yeah, it's Amityville is, you know, overrated, and I'm like, I don't know. I think it's still very creepy.
And it's, isn't it funny that it's the name of a town back in Long Island where I'm from, and it's becomes like synonymous with haunted house. Like you could just say Amityville. Oh, it's a movie like Amityville, and that means
it's
haunted house.
Yeah. Definitive. Yeah. You've been outside this real house?
Yes. They're thrilled that you think that about their town.
Okay. I'm sure.
Okay.
Ooh, classy.
Oh, yeah.
Is this Axel's?
Yes. So my number five is The Ghost and Mrs. Muir, which is not technically a horror movie, I guess, so it wouldn't qualify as one of the scariest. But I saw that when I was little, and it's kind of a romantic story about this woman who was recently divorced, and she moved into this little cottage by the sea. I think it's supposed to be in England, I think, although it was shot in California. And she realizes that the house is haunted by the ghost of this old captain, and he's very charming. He's Rex Harrison, and she starts writing about his life, and it's just really touching and very funny, and like two leads who have great chemistry, and I promise I will find something scary for the next ones. but I love it. And I kind of forgot about it. I saw it when I was very, very young, and then I completely forgot about it. Then I make some short film, and then I made my feature, and then I rewatched The Ghost and Mrs. Muir, and I was like, shit, this is both my movies have been so heavily inspired by that. So yeah.
Number four on fire. This is my pick. Insidious Chapter 2. Yes, Chapter 2.
Wow.
I love the first one. Just context. I've only seen this movie once whenever it came out on home video a while ago. And I love the first movie. I think the movie's really scary and stands up. The reason I love this sequel and I picked it, because this is technically favorites, not scariest. This is one of my favorites because they had the balls to basically do the Back to the Future 2 in a horror movie. It was like, we're just going to go back into that first movie that you felt was so scary and show it to you from a different angle. And I don't really know any other horror movie or horror sequel that's ever done that before.
Yeah, maybe not Happy Death Day to you.
I haven't seen the second one yet.
Is
that a spoiler?
But I have to agree.
Sorry, Ryan.
Insidious 2 was really smart in that regard, where it took moments that I didn't even look at as moments in the first one and then turned them into ways that they were involved with it in the second. And it was really smart the way that they did that.
Yeah, and I know, I mean, maybe that pisses people off that are fans of the first one, because they do take some of the best scares of part one, and in part two, they show them to you in a way that's like, that wasn't actually scary, that was one of the characters in part two in the background doing something. And it, I don't know, it's just like, for horror movies, especially when you get to a sequel, you want to be surprised, and like, this is one that just completely, I knew nothing about it going in, and it just surprised me from start to finish.
And they added stepfather as well.
Stepfather angle awesome. In there, Patrick, which is great. I freaking love Insidious 2.
Okay, so I went, this is a Spanish film, I had to get some international picks in there. So my number four is The Baby's Room, directed by Alex de Iglesia. And I consider this would have been on my scariest list. This is definitely one of my scariest haunted house films. This had a very limited release here in the U.S. It was put on the six films to die for. It's called?
It's like, the six stories to keep you awake.
Keep you awake.
Yeah.
Because it's part of a series in Spain too.
Yeah, it was this this bulk release that they did about a decade ago, and this was part of it. There was also a Christmas movie on there that I really liked. But The Baby's Room is just a wonderful film standalone about two parents, brand new parents. They have just had an infant. They get a baby monitor, and on the very first night, he looks into it, and there's a guy standing next to his son's crib. And he goes running in, and no one's there. And then he starts realizing that there's all of these ghosts in the house, all of these different entities in the house, but he can only see and hear them on the baby monitor. And it really becomes clear very quick that these entities are trying to do damage to his son. But for some reason, his wife is unable to see them, It's only him. So then it also becomes a question of his own sanity. And amazing jump scares. They do so much with that baby monitor. And yeah, it's a hard one to find now, but I highly recommend hunting down The Baby's Room.
I did not know it was a ghost story. You've talked about it many times, and I always thought it was something else, not a ghost film.
No, it's definitely. Okay. I mean, well, it gets. I'm not even going to
say. Don't spoil it.
Oh, it's a ghost story. So that's The Baby's Room.
Oh, man. So I rewatched The Legend of Hell House yesterday in prep for this. And this holds up as a scary... So a couple of mine are scariest. I definitely put this... I know Axel was thinking about putting this on her list, too.
I love it,
yeah. There's a real... it's a really classy film. It's a really well-made film. Some great actors. You get to see a really interesting Roddy McDowall performance where he really pushes himself. But it's about a group of scientists, a medium... and a physical, what's it called? A physical medium? There's two different, there's an emotional medium and there's a physical.
Yeah, who can manifest things and one who's just I don't know what they call that.
Yeah, and they're all going to make $100,000 if they can successfully investigate this incredibly lavish estate. It's one of the most incredible buildings I've ever seen in a movie, which is called, we've got the nickname Hell House, and there's this guy who used to live there and he clearly had, there's a great speech where they go, you know, what's happened in this house? And they're like, you know, sodomy, cannibalism, they list off the lineage of our favorite topics, and it's pretty bleak. And then what happens is slowly they're kind of being divided as a group. Their sciences divide them, but they're also being divided by this, well, I don't want to spoil exactly who it is, but they believe it's the son of the guy who owned this place who's communicating with them, so they're trying to, the medium's trying to help him, maybe kind of bring him over. They discover a body in a wall at one point. I always think any movie with a hidden body in a wall is always a good reason to feel a house haunted. There's a cat that really brutally attacks a woman, which is, I'm always a fan of that subgenre. It's just one of the best.
I love that it's a subgenre.
There's like four films.
Cats and horror films.
But no, this is actually a really scary, it's a very adult horror. The ideas are big, but then where it goes, it just never lets up. It's quite unrelenting in what it's building to, because it's kind of got this little, somewhat newsreel-y, because every couple beats, probably at the scariest moment, it'll then just be like, you know, January 3rd. 2:54 the next day. So it doesn't stay in the scary moments. It quickly moves along. But if you haven't seen this, I'm pretty sure it's on Shudder. And it's a really, I think maybe it's a little underseen in this country, probably maybe because it's British, but really good movie.
Yeah, Scream Factory did a good Blu-ray of it too.
Yeah, it's good. Nice.
Oh, yeah, so my number four is The Devil's Backbone.
Yeah.
And I have no idea why. Sorry.
You were drunk when you made this list.
I found it so beautiful and fascinating. And it's one of those movies that start out being scary because you see things through the eyes of those kids in this haunted orphanage. And I guess it's a coming of age story in the sense that they start out thinking that the ghost, which is this beautiful, like the design of this ghost is phenomenal. But this little boy who died in the orphanage is the villain of the story. And then as the story goes, you realize that actually it's the humans. And I guess that's kind of what you realize when you grow up, is that the ghosts and the skeletons you're scared of are not as bad as the people that you meet. It's beautifully designed. It has that kind of haunted quality of... I love the way that it opens where it says, what is a ghost? It's an emotion trapped in amber. And it really feels like I've always been struck by that idea that a ghost could be just... someone or something that just you can't get through and you can't get past it and you can't move past something that's happened to you and you just get stuck in that anger or that sadness and there's something very nostalgic about the whole piece that really appeals to me.
I mean, it's interesting that we're even scared of ghosts when it would be proof of life after death.
Yeah.
I mean, but yet we all fear it. And I remember one of the reasons they don't show toilets, particularly in movies, right? And Hitchcock, when he showed in Psycho the flushing, one of the radical things, it's almost like these are things that humans don't want to know where the toilets go. We don't want to know where the people go after death. It's a strange analogy. Go with it. We're flushing our souls away. But I do think it's like we would rather not see the results. We don't want to know, which is a shame because it's, you know, it'd be fascinating to know.
The Devil's Backbone had such a smart plot construction because the movie itself is kind of slow burn. It's very soft. But it establishes at the very beginning that there is an unexploded bomb right outside of the orphanage. And so even though that you are getting this kind of slow, very serene kind of ghost story, very misty, it's all like with this B story of this unexploded bomb that they find in the middle of the courtyard and are then trying to figure out what to do with, or is this about to blow at any time? And it sets up this wonderful tense device that carries the plot along.
Mm. Yeah, very Hitchcock.
Excellent.
Number three.
Number three. Oh, really? Okay.
Isn't that what you put down? I went into it.
I forgot my pitch. Okay. This is 1408, which is apparently my number three.
Third favorite movie of all time.
Favorite ghost story. Yeah. No, I will tell you, I missed this in theaters. I ended up catching it, I guess, when it came out on DVD. And my memory is the movie's really terrific, except for the ending. Mm-hmm. I remember the reason it's not one of like my constant recommendations is because somehow they shit the bed at the end. I just don't remember exactly how. Mm. But the first hour, and I think this is where, this is obviously based on a Stephen King short story, but I think this is where adaptations work at their best. If you take a short from Stephen King or Clive Barker, one of these guys, and expand on it, yeah, it's usually a hell of a lot more successful than trying to take something ginormous that they wrote and condense it down, because then you lose some of the ideas. But they, you know, when you're going the opposite, when you're taking a short and just trying to expand on it. But yeah, it's, you know, John Cusack he's looking for basically what we were just talking about, looking for proof. He wants, mm-hmm, you know, he had a personal loss in his life and he just wants proof that there's something after. And so he goes into this room of this hotel where a lot of crazy, terrible shit has happened. And then it becomes kind of like a psychological mind game. And so I remember the last time I saw it, I was really into like the first 45, 50 minutes of it. And then, again, the ending doesn't really land as well as it should.
What's Sam Jackson doing? I cannot remember. I saw it when it first came out.
He's the owner of the hotel or like
yeah,
the
he's
belt?
The director of the... Yeah. There's a fantastic scene at the beginning where he explains everything that's happened in the hotel. Yes. And it's just like he deadpans all those horrible stuff. And it's such a great setup.
Yeah, you can't get better than Samuel Jackson. Yeah.
To explain your story, Marvel? Here's the whole universe. You know?
He's great at that.
And the movie, I love this one so much because it rides this beautiful line between psychological horror, because I would say 75% of the movie is John Cusack in a hotel room by himself. And so it's this wonderful psychological horror, this amazing ghost story, and then it's also hilarious. There's like these amazing humorous moments, and it kind of just goes between them all seamlessly up until the end.
Watch it again.
But yeah.
And a lot of good practical effects, I remember, in the room, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I'd say 50 minutes of it is my number three, for sure.
And a different list is the ending. Okay. Excellent.
Okay, so my number three is Lake Mungo, which I've already gotten in an argument with someone on Twitter about, is this a ghost story or not?
Is that a spoiler?
No, not in any capacity. A girl drowns at a lake, and her family then finds her cell phone and all of this other stuff and kind of starts uncovering all these secrets about her that they did not know. And as they are doing it, there is something in the house with them. And it's set up as ghosts. There is something in the house with them. And it's moving things around, and it's kind of helping to explain the story of what happened to her. I love this movie because it's almost like a treasure hunt, where the first time that you watch it, you kind of just watch it as a straight ghost story. And then the second time I watched it, there was all of these little hidden things that I suddenly started realizing that had been left there. Did you guys feel the same way?
Yeah.
It was definitely like a scavenger hunt, where suddenly it took on a whole new meaning on the second viewing. And there are still people online that debate what the ending means. And I love that this one thing happens at the end and there's debates going on about, is it a ghost? Did someone else become a ghost that was not revealed? Was that nothing? You know, was it just the house settling? And it's, I
but that's
love
the real
that.
Reality of any ghost story should mm-hmm. end up with the question of, was it a ghost? Was it something else? Yeah, this is super creepy. I didn't see this till super late. And even though it's Australian, it's great. We have an Australian in the audience. Hi, Australian. Hey.
Do you know all of them?
Yeah. They're on our watch list. We got to be very cautious. But this was a good Australian, like, under-the-radar horror film, so I liked it a lot.
I think that's probably my favorite found footage movie.
Yeah, no.
Yeah. It is found footage. Even if you're not a found footage fan, do not let that stop you, because it's shot documentary style. Like, the family is being interviewed after this girl's death about what's going on and as they discover stuff. So it's not kids running through the woods with a shaky camera. am going, where's Todd? It's much more composed than that.
And yet even we all, you know, I think because found footage kind of had its time in a sense, I think we all give it shit. And when new ones pop up, we aren't that interested. But I still think it's the easiest way to scare people. I think the best found footage horror films are still scarier even today than most other horror films because of the way they're shot, the way you can hide a scare, the way you're limited by the frame. It's a really effective use of filmmaking, I think.
And this one in particular, I love it because it is a ghost story, but it's ultimately a story about trauma and how we each deal with it, where we either become kind of immediate, and specifically death, where we're either like, this person's gone, they're not coming back, they're gone. Or the other flip side of that, where we still feel something of them, their presence around us, and kind of how we respond to that. And if something was there that would make you question if this person may still be there, does it then become a scary thing that this person may still be here and be present? Or does it become something that you embrace and you're suddenly like, why are you still here? Or I'm so glad you're still with me. So it's everybody's, the family's response to it is just so cleverly calculated.
Quick survey, hands up if you believe in ghosts. Okay, for those listening, almost that everyone. Was actually probably more than 75%. Wow. So I think that's actually really interesting. That's a lot of believing in. That's a leap of faith, which because you don't know, which
could
I think
be
cool.
Worth pointing out for League Mungo that I could be wrong, but I think the picture on the poster has absolutely nothing to do with the movie.
Not a damn
thing.
Not
really. It should just be a cell phone or something.
Yeah. No, this was definitely about 10 years ago when they started playing the what image is trending best. Let's put that on like four covers.
Oh, the crawling girl.
The crawling girl. Yeah, the eye with something else happening in the pupil. Yeah, we've definitely been there. Okay.
Oh, me again. This is actually really one of my favorite movies. Okay, so a lot of us were talking about these houses with poor families.
Say what it is.
Whipped in the Body by Mario Bava. A lot of people, we're talking a lot about these people who need to move into suburbia, but I feel bad not also representing the 1%, which are the people who live in castles. Because a castle can be haunted too, and upper class problems are still problems. And even though I'm not into S&M, I find this film really sexy. The people in it are very into S&M, and it's a really racy movie. Who was it? Producer of Tales from the Hood,
Darren Scott.
Darren Scott came on our show years ago, before we were Shockwaves or Killer PV. It's like episode 10 or something. And this is just one he recommended to us that I hadn't seen, and I watched it straight away, and I've loved it ever since. Started watching again this morning. Christopher Lee as Dracula. I guess I always hear he's sexy. I've never thought that watching Dracula. Yeah, I personally have never felt that sex appeal from Dracula. In this film, I totally feel this guy's boss. He just walks in, it's terrifying. He just has this like power and presence, and he basically is a baron type character. He comes back to his family's castle, which he has been missing for years because the woman he was engaged to ended up committing suicide because he treated her so poorly, and so everyone holds it against him.
Did you just say he's sexy in this movie?
He's really sexy in this movie. It's like crazy.
No,
like, he can totally
isn't.
Whip me. I'm telling you. I'm a straight man I'm going to be whipped by Christopher Lee. I'm telling you the truth.
Bougie right Dracula there. As like the injured artist.
We can't argue what I find sexy. That's not even like a debate.
This it's is like abusive husband.
Yeah, I know, but it's like creepy sexy, you know? I'm not saying it's good. I mean, I feel bad for her, but she's
totally
into it.
I will take Bougie Dracula and bougie, over
okay,
this.
Well, you get Bougie Dracula. Anyway, he comes back to this town. They're all kind of talking about how he wants his estate back. His dad's still alive. He's making plans to basically take his ex-girlfriend, who is now married to his brother, and she's still really into him. And they have this really dark relationship where she really enjoys being whipped by him. I know, it's a hard sell in the modern era. Not the easiest. But you start watching it, and very quickly they dispatch of him. And you can't really tell if he was murdered by a ghost at the start or if somebody was hiding. You never kind of get to see that at the start of the movie. But he's out of the picture pretty quick, and then he starts haunting. He wants to get revenge, but he's also haunting her in this weird, like the entity, I guess, but in it's way different because it's shot so romantically. And that's probably what I mean by it's actually just the photography that's sexy. It's not I mean, really, this is one of the best looking movies I've ever seen. Like the cinematography on the way they shoot him when he's seducing her. There's a shot where he's like leaning in to kiss her as a ghost, and they change the color filter on him like four times, and it's a different color as he gets closer to her lips. And it's just little evocative things like that and the reason why I say that's important is otherwise you wouldn't be able to watch this. You'd be watching it going, why am I watching a guy whip a woman but the way they can evoke that. I'm not going to get into the whipping.
It's beautifully shot, dude. It's no timey up, timey down. It's beautifully shot.
1408 is the second half of 1408 is my pick. I'm scratching Whip of the Body completely. No. No, this is a really, really great film. I can't say enough about it. I think I've said enough. Revealing.
All right, my number three is The Classic. Haunting. To be honest, I would probably have put it number one.
I think we can debate that.
But yeah, again, like it's one of those movies that show so little. I don't even think you see anything at all, and yet it's absolutely terrifying. It's so beautifully shot. It's they used all those lenses that were kind of revolutionary at the time and make everything feel distorted and very strange. And one of the reasons also that I wanted to have this one on the list, besides the fact that it's a masterpiece, was that I love The Haunting of Hill House so much.
So good.
Because I grew up watching The Haunting, I was really kind of anxious about the TV show and the Netflix show. And then watching it, I've watched it twice and I absolutely adored it. And so it seems like there's more to that story that we can still kind of mine and find into. And
didn't the story, like the kernel of this story also was the Legend of Hill House kind of came from the same kernel in terms of the event?
I don't know. Okay. Like, you mean it's like, based on something? Because they're based on two different books. But
different books, but I think that the original, because obviously similar structures and people investigating a home.
I mean, there was tons of studies going on in the 1960s with parapsychology and the whole element of, you know, what can you see? Do your dreams mean anything? We were hippies and doing a lot of drugs and wanted to explore it. And so, I think that these studies were kind of prevalent preceding these films, so I'm pretty sure that they probably had the same source material.
There was the Quater mass movies, and that's the start of that idea of investigating scientifically supernatural phenomena. But yeah, I think this one is the best.
And you know, this one taught me, several years ago, I used to work on a lot of short films with a guy named Drew Daywalt, and he would always cite just the one scene where you hear something outside the door and it's like a close up on the door handle, the doorknob, and just saying, like, we can take that 3 minutes out of this movie. And it's one of the scariest shorts you've ever seen. And that was kind of the philosophy about how you can set up a scare for a short film, is like, just look back to The Haunting. Like, they did it several times throughout. So I've always remembered that, and I always think about that every time I revisit this movie.
It's literally
the original, by the way.
Yeah,
not
it's the ultimate in the importance of sound. Yeah. It's probably one of the best sound design films, but also with ghosts, because you're not seeing things for the most part, sound is always scarier, and because our imaginations are just so much, you know, sharper. And I know a lot of people talk about if you're already nailing the sound, you don't also have to nail the image. You can get one. The problem with the remake is it goes for the opposite, which it goes for the spectacle. It wants to show you all the scary things, and they're bad CGI, and it just doesn't hold up.
Yeah, there was a big Uncanny Valley with that, where the ghosts just didn't look real enough for us to perceive them as scary in any capacity. But the original is amazing.
This one was based on a Shirley Jackson story, obviously. And I remember reading something that I thought was kind of interesting, is that the film and the TV show have this in common, that you can see this as a haunted house, or you can see it as someone's mental illness, I guess, coming to play in this place. And Shirley Jackson never saw it like that. She always saw it as a ghost story.
Interesting.
Number two. I'm anticipating this. What is this? Oh, okay.
You've seen this, right?
I have seen it.
All right.
You picked this one.
This is The House That Dripped Blood.
Is Christopher Lee sexy in it?
My memory, sure. I mean, he always is. He's no Frank Langella Dracula,
that's hard to do.
Christopher Lee, Peter Cushing. This was written by Robert Bloch, who wrote Psycho, the original. And this one, it was a while before I got to see this one. I was fortunate enough to catch it. They showed it at the New Beverly, so I got to see it on the big screen. I think on a double bill with Asylum, which is another great anthology. But about 2 Octobers ago, I set upon doing the insane task of 31 days of anthologies, which Elric's like, that's like 150 movies. And I'm like, yep, I survived. But this was one of them. What's the wraparound?
Of this one?
Yeah.
I don't remember this. I remember the Asylum wraparound. I don't remember this one.
Is this
the one with the wax museum thing?
Yeah, that segment's in there. The wax museum segment, I think.
Jacob knows the wraparound.
Jacob knows. That's it.
Repeat that for those at home.
Yes.
Jacob Davidson, ladies and gentlemen.
Trivia. Good at trivia.
Sorry, my brain. I'm just drawing a blank here. It's a police inspector investigating a house where murders took place. And as they're retelling some of the stories, it kind of, that's the wraparound that gets you into these anthology stories. So, super
ghost stories?
No. There's a witchcraft one, I think, with Christopher Lee that's fantastic.
Yeah.
Tisk, tisk.
House that dripped blood.
I, unlike Elric, I don't rewatch them right before we do this.
I had spare time.
So my number two just hit the States last year, and this is Satan's Slaves. It was also on my top 10 list of films from 2000.
I think 3 of ours, right? Maybe?
Yeah,
I think it was on a lot.
It was on Shudder.
Shudder exclusive.
Yeah, this is a Shudder exclusive here. It's an Indonesian horror film, and I fell in love with this so quickly. I had no idea what to expect going in, but the scares come fast. They come furious. The story's compelling. You're watching a different culture, but it's still very accessible. The story's in it. It's about a woman who dies who is this famous singer. And immediately after she dies, her family is still in this large house. And they start experiencing these weird occurrences. And you eventually found out that she may have made a pact with something to kind of give the house presence, we'll say, without giving any spoilers. But yeah, it's just wonderful scares. Some of the best orchestrated jump scares I'd seen in years with this one. So
it
yeah.
feels big. It feels like a James Wan film, which often with foreign horror, you don't expect something to be this big. It feels like a bigger budget, a bigger canvas.
Yep.
It's really cool.
Yeah, the acting, the cast in it is amazing. The house, the setting in it is just diabolical. It's wonderful. So that is Satan's Slaves from Indonesia. And it's on Shudder now still.
If you like any of these, you can like go whoop.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Or you can boo.
Yeah,
or.
Yeah, you can boo us. That's
we're okay. We could take it.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
This was going to be on my list.
Yeah. Well, this was the one I mean, I've just been ranting about this since Killer POV days. I only saw it back then. Haunting of Julia, otherwise called Full Circle. The person whose book led me to this was Kayla Janice's what is it called?
House of Psychotic
House of
Women.
Psychotic Woman. And I found quite a few really interesting movies from that. But this one, even it's on HD on Amazon, and even then it has all this weird flashing happening throughout. So it's obviously a troubled transfer. I have a feeling the soundtrack has no soundtrack except for score and dialogue. So I think there's a missing element of like sound effects. But I would still encourage watching it on there. It's Mia Farrow, very close to Rosemary's Baby, Mia Farrow. It has one of the most tragic openings I've ever seen in a horror film, or any film, where just they're having breakfast around the table, her and her husband, Keir Dulia from 2001, I always struggle with his name, and their daughter just starts choking on like cornflakes and a piece of apple, and they can't stop her from dying, and she's in their arms, and watching it in real time, that alone is probably one of the most horrific deaths I've seen. And then it, you know, the couple split apart because they can't handle the trauma, and everyone thinks she's, you know, losing her mind. She moves into this new house. So this is all set in London, and in the new house, she starts getting in touch with what she thinks, kind of like Don't Look Now, where she thinks she's maybe seeing her daughter run around initially, and she's trying to like find out, and there's a seance and a whole, that's where the Full Circle comes from. She starts digging deeper, and it's really one of the darkest stories. I rewatched it last night, and I was like, wow, this is really bleak. She basically finds that, well, I don't know how far I want to take this, but she basically finds out that this little girl's spirit had done something really bad in her lifetime, and she's still trying to invite the spirit in towards her because she misses her daughter so much. So it's really tragic, but it actually, and there's somebody bumping off a bunch of the people, and her husband and people like that are all kind of being picked apart by some entity. It's a really effective, very under the radar, probably because no DVD or Blu-ray release in this country. So the only way I know of seeing it right now is Amazon. But I'm sure that'll change at some point. Really effective. You a fan of that one?
I like it.
Yeah,
I'm not crazy about it.
Because it's kind of like slow burn art house as well.
Yeah,
but
yeah. And it was a total commercial bomb, apparently.
Oh, I'm
and
sure.
It took like 3 years to come out in the U.S., and that's why they changed the title and try to make something different out of it.
But it's, if you like that kind of, it's really grim. I'd definitely say that.
I found that in the 70s, every movie that had a ghost seemed to be about a woman who just lost a kid.
Yeah.
Is she crazy? Is she not crazy? She just came back from the mental hospital, and she comes back, and her husband doesn't believe her.
So we just got the 10-minute warning. So we got to do 2 minutes each on our top five.
Okay.
That's okay.
The Woman in Black. I mean, who hasn't seen The Woman in Black? Great, everyone's seen The Woman in Black. There you go.
I've never seen that. Isn't there a TV movie original? I've never seen that.
There's a, well, originally it's a
novella. Oh. And then it was adapted into a play in the West End in London, and it's the longest running play, I think. Oh. It's still running to this day. It's very good. I want to see it. It's really cool.
Like,
you can hear people sometimes literally scream in fear in the theater, which doesn't happen much. Which makes me think of another ghost film that is not on my list, but Ghost Stories, if anyone hasn't seen that.
Also
based on the play. Written
by the same person as Haunting of Julia, right? Peter Straub?
You're thinking Ghost Story.
I am thinking Ghost Story. Yeah. Thank you.
I'm thinking Ghost Stories.
Oh, that movie that came out last year.
Came out a couple of years
ago. I deeply enjoyed that as well.
Yeah, really fun.
Yeah, so Woman in Black it's Hammer doing their first Ghost Story, which I've always wondered what it would have been like if they'd made one back in the 60s or the 70s. I suspect it would have been like Legend of Hell House. Like that kind of feels a little bit like...
Was it just the popularity of the monster movie?
I don't know.
That's strange when you said.
But the British horror Ghost Story is such a staple, and there hadn't been many. Like, it's a literary staple, but there hadn't been so many movies. And so, yes, there was an adaptation in 89, I think BBC or one of the British channels, and then Hammer came back in 2012, I think, and made this, and it was the very beginning of the new wave of ghost stories, and it kind of kicked it off, and because there hadn't been many at that point, and it's very gothic, and it looks beautiful, and it's this old house and everything, I loved it.
Yeah, I remember when Hammer came back, everybody was kind of unsure what they would do, and they did a really small film first called Wakewood, which is actually...
Oh, they did Beyond the Rave first, which was a web series. That was their big kickoff to come back.
And then they did Wakewood, but then to go from Wakewood, which was, I'm sure it had like a small theatrical, but it was basically like a direct-to-video title, to this, which was massive,
nationwide.
I think
there was The Resident was in there, right.
Yeah. So yeah, this was definitely like exploding. Loaded for them.
And I'm super excited to see The Lodge, which is the next one.
Actually, somebody's seen it.
I've seen it.
You've seen it.
Yeah. I won't say anything yet.
Don't spoil it, Howard.
That's number one.
This is my pick. This is The Innkeepers by Ty West, which I love. I think it's a really cool little movie. I like all of Ty's movies. He's doing a lot of TV these days. I want him to get back to features. But whereas The House of the Devil approached kind of in a similar... I mean, it's not a haunted house movie, but it's the house is such a character. This is him going straight for it, maybe injecting a little bit of humor with kind of the characters.
You should tell them what this was inspired when they were making House of the Devil. Right?
Yeah, this was actually inspired by... It's the actual hotel they stayed at while they were making House of the Devil that they all were convinced was haunted.
Yeah, yeah.
So he wrote it, and it became his next movie.
Cool,
But no, it's a really interesting film, and the one thing that we got out of when he was on Killer POV... Was it Killer POV?
Yeah, he was
on Killer POV a while ago, and we talked a bit about this because... It's kind of divisive. I remember when it came out, it was kind of divisive. And I noticed that a big part of why it was divisive was because of something that you either see or you don't see in the final shot. I totally see something in the final shot. It's not a spoiler, but there's an image within the image if you're paying attention to it. And to me, it's like that explains the whole movie. I'm like, oh, that's really cool. Mm. But then anybody that doesn't really like the movie, they're like, I don't get it. And I ask them, did you see that image at the end? They're like, no, there's something at the end. And I'm like, yeah. And we asked him about it. And I was like, hey, how do you feel about, you know, people that you see it or don't? He's like, I don't care. I did my part. Like, I can't force you to see something if you don't see. If you don't see, you don't see. That's not my problem.
Yeah.
Which I thought was kind of hilarious.
So it in itself has become a supernatural entity.
Yes.
Right.
Which actually I think that's kind of interesting. Kind of has the power. But if you haven't seen it in a while, I would revisit it and pay extra close attention to the final shot of the movie.
And it's funny. It's kind of like watching a video store film because the two characters are like on the waning days.
Pat Healy's
hilarious, and Sarah Paxton, both from Cheap Thrills, which is another absolute stunner, I think. But yeah, I just love the way they talk and hang out. That platonic friendship is really cool.
So my number one is Stir of Echoes. This movie did not get the attention it deserved when it came out, and it is still one of my favorite ghost films to revisit. Kevin Bacon.
Do you remember why, though? Because here's the thing. This came out after The Sixth Sense.
Mm-hmm.
So it was The Sixth Sense, and then this was a few weeks after. I saw a test screening of this before I saw The Sixth Sense. And so I saw this one first and thought, holy shit, this movie's going to be so freaking huge. And then it got kind of cut off by The Sixth Sense, which I thought was like, oh. Yeah.
Right. This was a really weird time for horror in general because we had films like The Sixth Sense. We had what I'll call art dread horror films, but they were all kind of, we wanted Shyamalan or Shyamalan. Hmm. And then this was right also when torture porn was entering the scene. And so we as a nation was kind of pushing more towards violent stuff. This was around Hills Have Eyes time period, Texas Chainsaw remake. And so we were kind of riding this line between PG-13, jump out and scare you movies and take out somebody's spleen and beat them with it movies. And so, and there wasn't much in between. And this definitely feels kind of in between the two, where it's an art dread, but it feels way more violent and off the hint, like way more unhinged than a lot of the other kind of slow burn art dreads that we were seeing at the time. Why it ultimately fell off so quickly, I'm not sure of. But yeah, I loved this one so much. It just blended so much different elements with it. And I don't. I wish Kevin Bacon did more horror. I mean,
I got to see it. I've not seen it since it came out. And
really?
I just keep thinking, does it have some changeling like echoes of how the
a little bit,
body
a little
stuff
bit.
Found?
Yeah, it's a kid. Okay. I mean, like okay. you, yeah, so maybe you get that's that my there's brain. Like okay. children involved.
Interesting.
So.
Okay.
But yeah, Stir of Echoes. This scared the crap out of me when I saw it in the theaters at the time period. Like it was one that I there are these amazing scenes where he goes to a hypnotist and she teaches him to hypnotize by sitting in a theater by himself in the darkness, and he'll stare at the blank screen and words will appear and it will tell him what he's supposed to do. And those scenes just resonate. Maybe it's because I spend most of my life sitting in a dark theater. But those scenes just resonated so much with me, and the idea of focusing and trying just to picture one word and one word summarizing things for you is just in really good jump scares.
And that's what triggers it, is when he gets hypnotized. Because it's Kevin Bacon, and he's like a contractor, doesn't believe in this stuff. He gets hypnotized and then kind of becomes obsessed with like a missing, I think it's a missing girl in town or something like that. Mm-hmm. And he's seeing clues about it.
Mm. Yeah.
Okay.
So Stir of Echoes.
My number one. When Baby Jane is the most normal character in your movie, you are in deep shit. And that's what happens in this movie. Like, Bette Davis is the most sane person in this cast. And I'm watching it going, how did that happen? She's so cute, too. I don't know why she's on the poster.
That's because she's facing Karen Black.
I know. Yeah. But everyone else is so bonkers in this. This movie is, I think this is A, really fun, but it's also quite scary. And it has a couple of the most disturbing scenes I've seen in a movie.
Burnt offerings.
Oliver Reed, Karen Black are the couple, which is already crazy. And they are looking for it. It's never really explained exactly why, but I know he's a professor who's during summer hasn't got as much money, so he's looking for a rental.
Yeah, they make it clear that they're having a lot of financial problems as a family, and that they do this as like a, oh, well, we get to live in this nice fancy house for the summer, and it only costs this much.
It's
with a kick.
It's a mansion that is, very depleted and kind of falling apart and overgrown, and it looks kind of terrible when they get there, but it's huge. And so they find out it's going to be $900 for the entire summer. They decide to move in, and then one of the interesting things you see early on is all these pictures. Like, you might have a wall of all the kids as they grow up. This house has all these different pictures of the house at different times through different eras, all framed on the wall, and it's super weird. And as the movie goes, you start to realize, and it's Burgess Meredith. There's an old couple who are brother and sister who are the ones renting the place, and they say, okay, but our mother is also going to be here all summer. You won't see her much.
Just take
She's
her
up there.
Food.
Just take the food. So you don't see her for the whole movie. 90% of it. I won't go there with it ends. But they basically start working on the house, and they become fairly obsessed with working on the house and doing it up. And they, Karen Black especially, just becomes obsessed with cleaning and polishing, and she kind of loses herself through this film. And there's a scene where Oliver Reed and his son have fixed up the pool, and this is, I watched it again yesterday, and really, it's almost too much to watch. And he finds a pair of spectacles that must have been from a previous owner, and he puts them on briefly, and then he basically becomes, I don't know if he becomes evil, but he's playing splashing with his son, and then he starts holding his son under, and he starts throwing his son, and he keeps doing it, and Bette Davis is on the sideline trying to get him to stop, and it keeps going and going, and literally you're sitting there watching going, oh my god, this kid is going to drown. Even if it's the actor, it feels very intense. Mm-hmm. And then you start to see them all, basically becomes kind of like a family psychodrama where they're all slowly being taken over, especially Karen Black's character. They're also having marital problems, so it's almost echoing what probably they moved in with that wasn't under the microscope yet, and then they can't leave, and it's really become a the film where you realize, you know, the house, if this was a vampire film, the house is the vampire and it needs a family to feed on. And I won't tell you exactly how it ends, but it's...
Well, I just love that the prior family, Burgess, I think it's Burgess Meredith's character, says it at the beginning because he says, what do we need to do around the house? Tell me how to take care of the house. And he literally looks at me and goes, the house will take care of itself.
Yeah.
And it's like, oh, okay. But it's in that... It's a gothic horror, but it works in reverse of traditional gothic horrors. Because if you look at like traditional gothic horrors, like Fall of House of Usher, it's all about as the character's sanity depletes, the house gets more and more run down and falls apart. Crimson Peak works the same way. As the character's sanity goes, the house goes. This, as the character's sanity goes, the house is reborn.
Yeah,
it's, and it's so
it's
fun.
Really, it actually feels really original. But if you like bonkers movies as well as scary, this is a really good pick because some of the performance stuff is fascinating. It's
I
a crazy movie.
Seeing this one and thinking it was like an hour and 30 minutes of Karen Black and Oliver Reed doing chores around the house.
Yeah, yeah.
And then the most batshit 10 minutes I've ever seen at the end.
I love watching people do chores. So I'm good. It's my favorite.
Okay, that's a fun one to end on. So my number one, I should have numbered them because that's a bit wacky.
I just went in order that you sent the email because I assumed that was your order.
It's Encounters of the Spooky Kind, which is a Sammo Hung movie from the early 80s. So it's Hong Kong, and it's a little bit of a curveball because I don't know if you can technically say that it's ghosts, but it's Jiangshi, which is like the hopping vampire.
Vampires.
Hopping vampire, hopping ghost is a little bit, the line's a little bit blurred. So the hopping vampire or a hopping zombie or whatever comes from the fact that in ancient times when someone died away from their village and had to be brought back to the village, it cost a lot of money to bring that person back. And so sometimes people would illegally take the body of their deceased one at night and tie the arms on bamboo sticks and hold the bamboo sticks on their shoulders. And then the body would look like it was bouncing. And because people would wear black so they wouldn't be seen, all you would see from a distance at night would be like a corpse bouncing with their arms outstretched. And so that's where that comes from, that idea that vampires hop with their arms outstretched.
And they would bind their feet together as well.
And it looks super goofy.
Yeah, and so that's what you see in all of the especially the Chinese and Hong Kong cinema. They have these hopping zombies with their feet bound. And sometimes their mouths are closed, some closed as well.
And so in this one, Sammo Hung plays a guy who's lost a bet, or is usually told that he's a coward. And so he's like, no, I'm not. And he decides to spend the night in this mausoleum. And what he doesn't know is that there's like this necromancer who's sleeping with his wife and is trying to get rid of him. And so the necromancer does this spell so he can control the body that's in the mausoleum. And at night, this body kind of sits up like Dracula style, like straight up with his arms outstretched and starts hopping about and trying to grab him. And it's hilarious. It's wonderful. It has awesome kung fu sequences. It has, it's kind of spooky. It's really awesome. I recommend, you tell me if it's a haunted house or not, but I recommend it anyway.
Cool. Encounters of the Spooky Kind.
Yeah. Well, guys, that's it.
Yeah, thanks so much for joining us, Midsummer Scream.
That's like the shortest show we've ever pulled off.
I know. I can't believe we got it in an hour.
Wow, we did it. Yeah, feel free to, if you have questions, because we obviously don't have time to answer them on mic, please come find us and ask us what you want. Thanks for coming.
Thank you guys so much.
Super cool. Thanks, Axel, for
coming. Thank you, Midsummer Scream.
Yes.
Severin Films presents the first ever authorized Blu-ray in America of Sergio Stivaletti's Wax Mask, produced by Dario Argento from a story by Lucio Fulci. Wax Mask was to be Fulci's last movie, but he passed on to the beyond during pre-production, so Gore FX maestro Stivaletti took over and created a splat-tastic House of Wax Grand Guignol Italian horror epic, packed with commentary, behind-the-scenes footage, and a feature-length making of featuring Argento, Stivaletti, and cast and crew, plus the limited edition slipcase version includes a remastered soundtrack CD. Dario Argento presents Wax Mask on Blu-ray. Also, Don't Crawl, Run, Killer Crocodiles coming to Blu-ray from Zombie and the Beyond producer Fabrizio De Angelis and FX guru Gianetto De Rossi comes the Italian giant croc gut muncher you've been waiting for the first time ever in America. Limited slipcase edition includes the equally crunchy human reptile fodder flick Killer Crocodile 2. Packed to the teeth with special features and available at www.severin-films.com. Bundles and deals and pins and shirts and the most sordid and sickening kind available only
only at www.severin-films.com. Why, we still have a few copies left of The Uncanny, starring Peter Cushing, Ray Milland, Donald Pleasance, with limited slipcover, and the last copies of the Hemisphere Box of Horrors, featuring The Blood Drinkers, Curse of the Vampires, Brain of Blood, and The Black Cat. And all of this can be found at www.severin-films.com. Fright Rags is the number one source for horror t-shirts. With specially curated collections created by renowned horror artists, they offer the best art and the best quality anywhere. Turn back the pages of your childhood for some scary stories to tell in the dark. An all-new collection of shirts based on the brand new movie out today. Also, Fright Rags is busting some ghosts with their all-new collection of Ghostbusters tees, socks, and pins to celebrate the iconic film's 35th anniversary. Listeners get 10% off with the code WAVES10. Again, that is 10% off by using code WAVES10.